Hey, you guys. Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. I got some guests coming up, as per usual. Not always, but usually. William M. Arkin is going to be on the show. You know, I've always wanted to interview him about lots of different things that he wrote. But now it looks like I'm going to have a chance to. He is now blogging at Gawker.com, believe it or not. It's the wave of the future, man. Washington Post is a dead letter, dude. So William L. Arkin, he is now at Phase Zero. That's the name of his blog. And others blog there, too. It's not just him. But that's where he blogs. Phase Zero at Gawker.com. And he does national security beat stuff. Sometimes journalism, sometimes analysis, writes books. Remember when the Washington Post did that big series? It was valuable. I'm not saying it was perfect, but it was valuable. Top Secret America with, I believe it was, Dana Priest and William Arkin. It was a big, 5-6-part series, something like that, that came out about 3 or 4 years ago, all about the contractors and the rise of the Homeland Security Industrial Complex. He also wrote a book called American Coup, which is about that as well, the massive domestic military-industrial complex, you know, the Homeland Security Industrial Complex, and then plus the privatization of it all and all the perverse incentives baked in. And always wanted to read it. It's on my pile of gonna read someday, god dang it. If I could just have like 100 Saturdays in a row, I could get some yard work done and get some books read, you know? Anyway, so Arkin's going to be on the show. Man, he's got a thing here. Well, I don't want to spoil it for you, but how about, I won't tell you too much, but the headline is, "This shadow government agency is scarier than the NSA. You might have read it. It was the spotlight on Antiwar.com yesterday. All right. Because I put it there. Leading defense think tanks urge U.S. to invest in baby nukes. This is something that I don't know if we'll have time to get to this. But, you know, the whole usable nuke industry. There's money in them there, Adams, if you can lobby the right senator. All right. So anyway, there's that. And also, guess what? Our good friend Doug Bandow is going to be back on the show today. And, man, he's really good on a lot of stuff. Occasionally, he recommends the U.S. government do things. Never wars or anything like that, but, you know, sometimes he recommends that they continue to exist and collect our taxes. I mean, implicitly. So that's all right, though, because, man, is he non-interventionist and also expert. Truly expert on all these regions and countries and policies. He reminds me a lot of Ron Paul, actually. Which, by the way, I'm working on trying to get Ron Paul on the show today, and I don't think it'll probably work, but maybe try. But, you know, he's a lot like that, too. You ask him about Korea, and he can really tell you about what's going on in Korea if you get into it, you know? He has his, like, his pat answers that he gives to the CNN folk, but he also has, you know, real expertise. So that's like Bandow, too. And Bandow, part of his, comparative advantage in the world is he's good on Asia, he's good on Korea, he's good on China, he's good on America's naval empire in the Pacific, our alliance structure in the Pacific and all that, so... really good stuff there. All right. Oh, I guess this needs to go up here. All right, cool. So there's that. Also, you know, I have an invite out to Peter Van Buren, who wrote a thing about the Islamic State that I think, I like it. I would hope that people take a look at it. I guess I would really like to think that Washington, D.C. folk are going to look at it because, he made it very easy for them to understand, I think. And, Man, I'm working on this sneeze, but it won't quite come out, and I'm just kind of in sneeze purgatory right now, halfway between sneezing and not. Oh, now it's gone, huh? Well, it's going to sneak up on me in a minute. God dang. Anyway, yeah, this article is about five possible strategies for fighting the Islamic State and how none of them will work, so just forget it. All right. I like that, you know? Now I'm the kind of guy who sit here and rant and rave and come up with, you know, as much different stuff to say about it as I can to try to oppose intervening over there. But, yeah, leave it to Van Buren to go ahead and give us a numbered list. You know, make it coherent for us. Here are five different ways you could approach this. All of them have their own failure baked right in. There's nothing you can do about it. So just forget it. And I think, hey, you know, I don't know. That sounds right to me. You know what I mean? So, Van Buren, he's a former State Department guy. And he wrote the book, Well, We Meant Well. And it's about how some of the people who went over there as part of the imperial occupation of Iraq believed that they were doing the right thing. They were trying to do the right thing. But of course, all they did was help to destroy Iraq. But anyway, so, you know, Van Buren, he's all right, man. He's not perfect on everything, but I think he's doing his penance, man. He shouldn't have been participating in any of this occupation stuff, and now he's making up for it by writing books and articles about why to just knock it off. And, you know, at one point he said, yeah, you know, we probably ought to ally with the Iranians. And I argued with him about it. And now he seems to say in this article that, yeah, no, that's not a good idea. None of these are good ideas. And he really gets into why, too. That's, you know, he was there. He was, I think, even stationed at the same base as Chelsea Manning. Right? I believe he said that before. So, yeah, anyway, he knows a hell of a lot about it. And I think he really did a great job on this. His five reasons, his five things we could do and all the reasons that he says they won't work are almost all right. I actually have one argument with him, but it's kind of a side point about the history of Iraq War II. It doesn't really change the context. It kind of changes the context of part of the article, but not much. And anyway. So, possibly either he or Ron Paul will be joining us on the show today as well. But we definitely got Arkin and Bandow, so that'll be good. Now, I hope I don't have any CNN auto playing in the background here on this channel, do I? Okay, good. Now hear this. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism versus Capitalism. Narrated. Well, why does it keep doing that? For Christ's sake, man.
By me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
Yeah, that kind of pisses me off, man. The VLC player always does me fair unless I'm live on the radio, in which case, it treats me terribly. God dang thing. All right, anyway. Yeah, but what you sort of kind of heard there in that spot is correct. Go to scotthorton.org, look in the right-hand margin. Down at the very bottom, you'll find the link to Fascism versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell, the audiobook narrated by me. Go and buy it.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe.
Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. So Van Buren can't do it, so here in a second, I'm going to tell you about what he wrote, because it's worth telling you about. Hey, man, that didn't work. God dang it, Bobby. All right, well, let's try this. Let's see how it goes.
Okay, guys, it's summer fun drive time at The Scott Horton Show. Bills are piling up and equipment is wearing out. So here's the deal. Anyone who donates $50 or more gets a chance to win a week's vacation for two to Costa Rica. Drawing is July 15th. Winner, go whenever you want. See more details at scotthorton.org/raffle. Anyone who donates $100 or more gets entered into the raffle, plus a 1-ounce silver QR code commodity disc from commoditydiscs.com. And the first 25 people to donate $100 or more will also get a copy of Your Money or Your Life, Why We Must Abolish the Income Tax by Sheldon Richmond, or the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism versus Capitalism, narrated by me, for free. Stop by scotthorton.org/donate or scotthorton.org/raffle for details. You can also sign up for monthly donations by way of PayPal, per interview at Patreon, support with Bitcoin, and shop through scotthorton.org/Amazon. And thanks.
All right, so there was that. And, hell, while we're at it, a little bit more about that raffle. If you didn't know, you could win a trip to Costa Rica. And sorry, for some reason my mic was down way low. I don't know if anybody could hear the entire first segment of the show today or not, or what. I mean, it wasn't that freaking low, but it was pretty low.
Yeah, check it out. Y'all want to win a free vacation in the jungles of Costa Rica this summer and help support The Scott Horton Show? You can. Joshua Hughes, peace activist and permaculturalist, runs Verde Energia Pacifica, an intentional community in the mountains of Llanos de Puriscal, Costa Rica, and he's offered to raffle off a week's stay to listeners of this show. Airfare is on you, but transportation to and from the airport, as well as a 7-day stay for you and a guest in your own private house with 3 meals a day, is covered. You can learn and practice some skills, or just go for a swim in their river, pool, or waterfall, walk jungle trails, enjoy the views, do yoga or dance in the studio, make art, play music, check out a local soccer game, or simply relax in a hammock by the river and read. Raffle tickets are just $50. Stop by scotthorton.org/raffle for details. And anyone who enters will get half off on any future stay down there. scotthorton.org/raffle.
All right, guys, so you know what? I'm going to get back to Van Buren's piece later on in the show, I think, unless we have Ron Paul on, in which case it'll just wait. I want to go to Robert Perry's article at consortiumnews.com. I've been falling down on the job on this and have not been covering the situation in Ukraine nearly enough. And, you know, the status quo seems to be holding, and the status quo means low-level fighting, but without official sanction, without an official breaking of Minsk II. It means American forces are there and training the National Guard, which is made up of a bunch of Nazis. Really. And it means that the government in Kiev is still dragging their feet on the so-called constitutional reform that was part of the deal, the peace deal, Minsk II, that said that they had to create a strong system of federalism and autonomy for the East and hold Ukraine together that way. And the Russians don't want eastern Ukraine. Oh, Vladimir Putin, he's on the march. He's conquering all of eastern Europe because he's a czar, Stalin, Hitler, taker overer of stuff. Except that really because all he did in Crimea was tell his troops to leave their bases where they were. They had a lease and they had a giant base that they kept after the fall of the Soviet Union. Crimea always belonged to Russia, not Ukraine anyway. Until 1954, when under the Soviet Union, when it didn't matter because everybody answered to the Kremlin anyway, the drunken Khrushchev decided to go ahead and give it to Ukraine. But anyway, not a single person was killed when Russia took Crimea. Do you know that? No one was shot to death in that. And German and other, you know, pollsters have gone over there and have above 90% approval of the population of Crimea for going to back to Russian, jurisdiction, the Russian Federation. So, I mean, again, I'm not in favor of any government existing, but as far as imperialism and expansionism, that hardly qualifies. And especially when, as Robert Perry writes, it was a reaction to what America and America's European allies did in Ukraine, leading up to the seizing of Crimea. But anyway, I'll get back to that in a second. The point is that they haven't said, and believe me, they could have, obviously, right? They could have said, okay, Donetsk and Luhansk, and hell, if they wanted to, they could go to Mariupol or all the way to Odessa and just say, okay, fine, eastern Ukraine belongs to us, and what are you going to do about it? I mean, does anybody doubt that the Russian army could conquer Ukraine, all of it, if they wanted to? After America's lackey Saakashvili picked a fight with Russia and lost in 2007, August of 2008, Putin said, well, of course, you know, I could get to Kiev in 2 weeks. Does anybody really want to try me? Does anybody really think I can't? And he wasn't saying, yes, this is my greatest ambition. I want to conquer Kiev and rule it. That's stupid. That's obviously counterproductive. But what he was saying was, if you think you're going to make Ukraine a member of the NATO military alliance against Russia, you're wrong. That's just not going to happen. And I'll prove it to you with fire. That was what he was saying. He wasn't saying Ukraine can't be independent. He was saying Ukraine cannot be a member of America's military alliance. That's what it can't be. And anyway, as Robert Perry writes in his article at Consortium News, and he's one of the best in America on this, I urge any of you to just search Perry, P-A-R-R-Y, Robert Perry at Consortium News, and the term Ukraine, and just go read 15 articles by him about this over the last year and a half or so, and I think you'll get it. Probably won't take you that many. But he's been really good on this. And all that happened, basically, what time is it? Oh, crap. The Americans had the Europeans tell the Russian-leaning president of Ukraine that it was an all-or-nothing deal. He could either have a trade deal with the West or with Russia. And if you take the deal with us, we're going to put all these new IMF restrictions on you and all of this stuff. And Putin countered with, I'll give you $15 billion worth of free gas if you stay with Russia on this. And it was the Americans and the Allies who made it all-or-nothing. Russia said, I don't care if you have a deal with them, but we can have a deal too. So the president opposed the trade deal, backed out of it with the EU. And so America and the European Union, European Union cronies, overthrew him. And they used a bunch of Nazis to do it. And that caused a civil war that's been going on for the last year and a half. And that's who's really at fault, Barack Obama, not Vladimir Putin. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place, and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code SCOTT when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me.
Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Our first guest today is William Arkin. And you might know him from his great blog that he had for years there at the Washington Post and the big series that he did with Dana Priest, Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. And then he's also the author of the book American Coup, Martial Life and the Invisible Sabotage of the Constitution. And he's got a brand new one coming out called Unmanned, Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare. And apparently now he's writing at Phase Zero, a blog at Gawker.com, phasezero.gawker.com. Welcome to the show, William. How are you doing?
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Very happy to have you here. Been a fan of your writing for a long time, and I admit that I have a book or two of yours on the pile of to get to someday back there. I sure hope I will get to, especially American Coup there. I'm very interested in that. On that whole line of investigation. And this article is very much along those lines. Everybody might have saw it was the spotlight yesterday on antiwar.com. It's this shadow government agency is scarier than the NSA. Now that's scary. What shadow agency is that?
Well, I wrote about the National Security Analysis Center, which is an obscure arm of the counterterrorism division of the FBI, which together with another obscure organization, the Foreign Terrorist Tracking Task Force, is essentially responsible for melding together intelligence information about both domestic and foreign threats to the United States. And so it's the only organization within the U.S. government that can lawfully collect information and investigate people who are both foreigners and American citizens. There's no other agency that has the authority to do so, and there's no other agency that can initiate these kinds of investigations. So that when we hear about the NSA or we hear about other agencies of the U.S. intelligence community doing things, it's generally in response to requirements, if you will, that are levied by policymakers or levied by law enforcement agencies that say, okay, we want to know information about X, Y, or Z. And in the case of law enforcement agencies, they want to know information about suspected terrorists, or they want to know information about people who are members of certain gangs, or whatever is their legal justification. But in the realm of terrorism, in this realm of what the government calls extremism, there are groups that are also justified as being worthy of attention and worthy of surveillance and worthy of intelligence collection. And once people are earmarked as being parts of those groups, the National Security Analysis Center is the only place and the place where they would have their where they would have their intelligence as well as their day-to-day transactional data checked to see whether or not they have actually committed a crime. So it doesn't even necessitate necessarily that someone is individually a suspect to a crime or that they have been indicted. It's more that this is a place where groups of people who are engaged in the same activity, let's say, for instance, members of the sovereign citizen movement or scientists who work in U.S. pharmaceutical companies that are of Chinese born origin. It could be as broad as that, in which case then intelligence and transactional data is evaluated to look for potential signs of lawbreaking.
Mm. Wow. So it sounds like a real state of, and as you describe in the article, real state of mission creep here, where it starts out maybe Al-Qaeda. Now we're talking about extremists, which is defining the enemy down to include, as you say, American citizens even too. And as far as the sovereign citizens, I can't say I know too many of them or something like that, but from what I know of them, the vast majority of sovereign citizens are basically what you'd call technicalitarians, who imagine that there are all these loopholes where you don't have to pay income tax or have a driver's license and this kind of thing. But that, you know, implies somewhere in there that like 0.00000000001% of them would ever shoot a cop or do something, you know, that is really dangerous. I mean, extremist in America to a politician really just means anybody who's interested in politics and expresses it in any other way than through the Democratic or Republican parties, right?
Well, I'm afraid to say that the answer to that question is right. I think that we are slowly drifting in a direction that is sort of caused by two clashing realities. One is 9/11 and our obsession with terrorism and our belief that terrorism is ever-present, and that not only ever-present, but that it is a growing phenomenon domestically, and that it doesn't only encompass foreigners, but also encompasses American citizens. And second is the computing power which has evolved since 2001, the vast ability of the intelligence community and the law enforcement community to not only collect and assemble huge amounts of data, but also to begin to link together disparate information from different databases, so that links and the relationships can be established, and that much of this work is even done in an automated way. And part of that automation is trying to discover wrongdoing through algorithms. So let's just imagine for a moment something that would be common. If you visited, say, for instance, a pornography site on the internet, and there was some way that was known to those who are monitoring internet activity, that might be flagged as something that would say, okay, well, these people, let's say, that would be probably all 350 million Americans, have visited internet porn sites. Now, take that down to something more specific. Let's say that someone listens to your radio show or identifies themselves as a patriot, whether that's right-wing or left-wing, or is a member of an activist organization that engages in direct action, whether that be Earth First or Greenpeace or whatever it might be, or is an anti-abortion protester or whatever. The individual himself or herself has never committed a crime of any sort, but their mere presence within the big data, if you will, makes them a suspect. Mm-hmm. And then from being a suspect comes a sort of weak legal predicate on the part of the intelligence community to begin to treat that citizen in a different way, which is to say that citizen, then there's a soft justification to look at their information in a more robust way.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm sorry, we got to stop and take this break, but that point exactly is where we're going to pick this up on the other side. letting the systems decide who's the suspect and who's not as the cops all go fishing on us.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
Hey, all, Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com.
All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, here on the Liberty Radio Network. Talking with William Arkin. He's writing at phasezero.gawker.com. This shadow government agency is scarier than the NSA. And there's all kinds of legalities and all sorts of other stuff to follow up on. But I wanted to pick up right where we were at the break there. You said something, I believe, William, very close to once they start scooping up all of the data on people who are political activists in America, then your presence, one's presence in that data becomes incriminating itself and the basis for further investigation, further suspicion. And basically implied in all of this is that anyone who's interested in politics but participates in it outside of the most narrow and official channels is a presumed violent threat. Might as well be ISIS or Al-Qaeda ready to get us if we don't spy on them all day and night and make sure that they're not. Is that basically right?
I think it is basically right. I'm sorry to say it. I really feel like, I don't believe that the government necessarily intends to infringe upon free speech. I don't think that it necessarily wants to make people into criminals when they're not. But the whole aesthetic which was created after 9/11 was one in which we essentially said to our federal law enforcement agencies, it's no longer good enough for you to merely deal with a crime after it has taken place. You have to now stop it from taking place. And 15 years later, we are essentially in a situation where the FBI has transformed itself into an intelligence-led police state, and part of its goal is to find people who might commit a crime, as opposed to just dealing with known criminals and suspected criminals. Or crimes that have been committed. And so that quest, that demand that we, the American society, placed upon the FBI, that it wasn't good enough for you to deal with a terrorist event after the fact. You had to catch the terrorist before the event. That in itself is now spilled over into all of society and all of law enforcement, and that combined with computing capabilities, which was the second post 9/11 phenomenon, which was oh my God, we didn't connect the dots properly. Has now led to this situation where people who are engaged in lawful First Amendment activity or people who are even sympathetic to law-breaking activity, which is an interesting thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could be sympathetic to someone's act of civil disobedience or thereby be connected to them under this paradigm. And so we are beginning to look at everyone in America who is not vetted and credentialed and part of the world of cleared individuals, if you will, as potential threats. And as potential threats, you know, our computer systems are increasingly able to isolate and investigate those that group of people.
All right. Now, so under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, if I understand it right, and I'm not the lawyer, Scott Horton, I'm the other guy. But if I understand it right, that, hey, if you it's a very low standard. It's not probable cause. It might even be, you know, not even a reasonable suspicion, but just any kind of suspicion that somebody is an agent of a foreign government or a foreign terrorist group. They're not a U.S. person, and they're not protected by the Fourth Amendment. And the standard for searching them from head to toe is, again, suspicion or less than that. And so I wonder under what legal authority. It doesn't sound like this thing has anything to do with FISA at all. Is there any judicial check here that, or this is strictly under an executive order by George W. Bush that no one has known about this whole time that has set up this sub department of the FBI that can just, that has a de facto general warrant on every single one of us?
Well, first of all, it's not just George W. Bush. I mean, this is Barack Obama as well. This is our federal government doing this, and doing this through and in over a period of two full administrations, in which there's been plenty of time to look at all of the crossed T's and dotted I's to understand the law. Laws like FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which was from the 1970s, and Title III of the U.S. Code, which is basically what allows for lawful wiretapping of criminal suspects, aren't even really relevant in these types of operations that I'm talking about, because this is intelligence collection, the purpose of which is to find wrongdoers. And so, of course, it starts from the standpoint of known and suspected terrorists. It starts from the standpoint of gangs, of drug runners, of groups of Americans that most people would readily identify as being worthy of the attention of the law enforcement authorities. But once you start, say, for instance, dealing with drugs and gun runners, and then maybe you start dealing with people who own guns or who sell guns, or once you start dealing with Muslim extremists, then maybe you start dealing with Muslim Americans and people who are even curious about Islam, and then you begin to create these promiscuous links between what we would probably agree are potential threats to public order and security into a generalized group, and of course that always just coincidentally includes people who are politically active, because those are the ones who are most likely to be out there on the streets. And so I'm not arguing, and I don't really have much evidence that says that there's any one group which is more of interest than another group. I'm merely saying, as you have said yourself, that political activity outside of a sanctioned mainstream, political thoughts that are outside of what is considered to be mainstream America begins to be more and more isolated as a marker of a potential threat.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you arguing that this is illegal? I mean, other than if someone wanted to argue a Fourth or First or Fifth Amendment type argument like that, but you know, when Snowden came out with all this stuff, the idea was, well, and it came out in the memos, right? He leaked the memo where they had secretly reinterpreted the Patriot Act out of all recognition to say what they wanted it to say. And I wonder if you think this is based on that kind of manipulation.
Well, you know, I've often resisted the temptation over many decades of writing about national security to label anything illegal. Once you do that, of course, it's have your lawyer call my lawyer, and we'll and they'll iron it out. So first and foremost, I'll say it's wrong. This notion that that we are guilty until proven innocent is just inimical to the American spirit and the American value system. And second, if the federal government actually believes that there is a group of people in American society who require special surveillance, then they have to publicly state so and get congressional and legal approval to do so. And I think that's where we stand today, that the federal government is deciding that they believe that a group of people demand special scrutiny, but they don't have the courage to say to the American public, we want to carry out this surveillance, and so therefore they do it in secret.
Mm-hmm. All right, everybody, that is William M. Arkin. The article is This Shadow Government Agency is Scarier Than the NSA. It's at phasezero.gawker.com. Thanks very much, William. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Scott.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
I love Bitcoin, but there's just something incredibly satisfying about having real, fine silver in your pocket. That's why commodity discs are so neat. They're 1 ounce rounds of fine silver with a QR code on the back. Just grab your smartphone's QR reader, scan the coin, and you'll instantly get the silver spot price in Federal Reserve notes and Bitcoin. And if you donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, he'll send you one. Learn more at facebook.com/commoditydiscs. Commoditydiscs.com.
Okay, guys, it's summer fun drive time at the Scott Horton Show. Bills are piling up and equipment is wearing out. So here's the deal. Anyone who donates $50 or more gets a chance to win a week's vacation for two to Costa Rica. Drawing is July 15th. Winner, go whenever you want. See more details at scotthorton.org/raffle. Anyone who donates $100 or more gets entered into the raffle, plus a 1 ounce silver QR code commodity disc from commoditydiscs.com. And the first 25 people to donate $100 or more will also get a copy of Your Money or Your Life, Why We Must Abolish the Income Tax by Sheldon Richman, or the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism versus Capitalism, narrated by me for free. Stop by scotthorton.org/donate or scotthorton.org/raffle for details. You can also sign up for monthly donations by way of PayPal, per interview at Patreon, support with Bitcoin, and shop through scotthorton.org/Amazon. And thanks.
All right, cool. So, enter to win a trip to Costa Rica, man. If you go to scotthorton.org/raffle and you click the link there to Verde Energia, whatever the hell, I don't know how to talk Spanish good or English. Click the link there and go and look at the pictures of that place. Spend a week in your own private house, 3 meals a day, got a river runs through it, jungle sounds and monkeys and birds and things, ocean nearby, free ride to and from the airport, not a free ride down to Costa Rica. You got to handle that. But, you know, I don't know. And guess what? Also, you help support the show by buying a raffle ticket. So, isn't that nice? Oh, and also, you can go whenever you want. And also, you better hurry because the drawing is in 3 weeks. So, enter now. Enter more than once. Enter many, many times. ScottHorton.org/raffle. Win a trip to Costa Rica. And hey, tell your friends about it, even if they hate liberty and peace. Or just kind of like it. You could tell them, hey, man, I know a radio show where the guy's raffling a trip to Costa Rica. If they're into that kind of thing, read all about it. All right. And this isn't some scam where, oh, we're promising you the most expensive resort and cruise ship and this and that, and it has a bunch of hidden costs and a bunch of, you know, whatever, like people complain about things that happen. This is a permaculture farm created by a peacenik who the business is he has people come down there and he teaches them permaculture farming. You know, he's living liberty in real life down there and teaching people all about it. You don't have to work when you go. You just go on vacation. That's what the place is. Ain't nobody lying and claiming it's some zillion-dollar resort, because who would want to go on vacation to a place like that anyway? But as Mike in the chat room said a couple weeks ago, hey, you had me at hammock. They got a hammock there? There's a hammock? And it's by a river, and I could lay in it? Hell. He entered. Sounds like a good idea to me. I can't win, because it's the raffles to support the show, so there's a conflict of interest there, so unfortunately, I gotta stay here in Texas while you guys go. Well, you and whoever you care most about. Anyway, scotthorton.org/raffle. And also, even if you hate Costa Rica and you don't want to go to stinking Costa Rica, you can still help support the show. It is a fun drive time on the show. I try not to do this very much, but I got to sometimes. Go to scotthorton.org/donate and find out all the ways you can support with Bitcoins. You can support at patreon.com. Pay a pittance per interview, if that strikes your fancy. You can sign up for monthly donations, subscribe by way of PayPal or single donations. I mentioned Bitcoin. Somebody sent me, a couple of people sent me half a Bitcoin the other day, or a Bitcoin and a half, or some kind of proportion of Bitcoin. Anyway, so yeah, I'm happy to take Bitcoins. Just stop by scotthorton.org/donate. And you can find the link right there at the top of the page at scotthorton.org. Help support the show. Think of how much you would miss it if there was no Scott Horton show anymore to tell you the what for about all the things that you need to know. So, there you go. scotthorton.org/donate, scotthorton.org/raffle. Also, stop by antiwar.com today and read Chase Madar's piece, HRW and Amnesty, Humanitarian Warmongers. Now, that's my title. He named it something else. I forgot. But it's in the London Review of Books, and it's about how Amnesty and HRW, their business is provoking intervention. And yes, it's true. They do some good work about criticizing governments who do bad things. But most of the time, their work is in the service of the empire, naming and shaming America's enemies and then supporting even wars against them. I remember being slightly amazed because not because of the institution, but just that anyone would support the war in Libya. I interviewed a guy from Amnesty, and there were a lot of people who were against the war who were saying, oh, Gaddafi's great. He gives everybody a free house and all this crap. And I was going, no, he's not great. He's horrible. That doesn't mean we should have a war against him. And it doesn't make him Saddam either. He wasn't that freaking bad, but he was pretty bad. He was a dictator. He goes straight to the lowest circle of hell. There's no question about that. And so I started the interview with the Amnesty guy going, well, come on, I mean, the guy, he's pretty bad, right? And the guy's like, yeah, he has all these prisons and he kills all these people and whatever, whatever. And then I go, yeah, but that doesn't mean we should bomb him, right? I mean, what kind of humanitarian catastrophe might that cause? And he's like, oh, yeah, no way. We love bombing. We definitely want to bomb him. What? You want to start a war? You're Amnesty International, the humanitarians, and you want to start a war in Libya? Yep. Them and Juan Cole. And so, yeah, Chase Madar, he's got their number, man. And I think Amnesty is worse than HRW. And I do interview their individual scholars and writers and lobbyists and whatever from time to time, because, like I say, they actually do good work from time to time. But, boy, you got to take it with a grain of salt and a little bit of background about whose interests they may or may not be attempting to serve with any particular piece of propaganda they're putting out. All right, so there's that. And then, what time is it now? Okay, good. I am going to have time to talk about the Peter Van Buren piece in the next segment.
So let me go back then again to Ukraine. I don't have time really to tell you much except about a bunch of sources. You need to read at consortiumnews.com, The New York Times Orwellian View of Ukraine by Robert Perry. Never mind the coup. Never mind the Nazis. Let's just pretend every fact that you don't like to fit in your little narrative doesn't exist at all, and just tell us all about how America is attempting to contain Putin's aggression. And how they just keep getting away with it over and over and over again. And I like the fact it really pisses Perry off. And he's right to target the New York Times. It's the most important newspaper in the world because it's the most important newspaper in the empire. And it counts for a hell of a lot in setting the agenda, as Chomsky would say, for the rest of the media. And man, are they lying. And especially by omission, but also by outright lie, too. Robert Perry, New York Times, Orwellian View of Ukraine. And then at news.antiwar.com, Jason Ditz writes, U.S. to pre-position tanks, artillery along Russian border, as I was telling you the other day. But then, where is this? Let me see if I can find this at the National Interest here. That's not it. Okay. Well, it's at the National Interest somewhere here. Let me see if I can find it for you, man. It was this guy. I told you about this actually on Monday or late last week or something, where the guy was talking about how expanding the amount of equipment in Eastern Europe is only a... God dang, I can't find it in time for the break. Sorry. In a sec, I'll tell you. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, guys. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. My website is scotthorton.org/donate. scotthorton.org/raffle. Hey, coming up, our friend Doug Bandow from Cato. Great on Asia. All right, I swear I want to get to this Peter Van Buren thing, but I found this article at the National Interest, and I wanted to tell you what it said because there's smart things in it. Paul J. Saunders at nationalinterest.org. Why arming Ukraine is a really bad idea. Why arming Ukraine is a really bad idea. It ran on June the 16th. And so he refers to the think tankers who have said, and remember, I went on and on about this for a couple of weeks or so on the show, where the head think tanker, it wasn't Strobe Talbot, it was the other guy, I forgot, the former ambassador, when Flournoy and Talbot and them put out that Brookings report saying arm Ukraine, where his argument on NPR was that, well, if we arm the Ukrainian military, of course it can't defeat the Russians, but it'll be able to kill more of them. And then that will cause the debate in Russia, quote, to go up. That will cause the debate in Russia to go up. And then supposedly, apparently what he meant by that was, well, if there are dead Russian soldiers, the moms of Russia will force Putin to stop fighting. Really? So, Paul Saunders says, okay, check it out. If the U.S. arms Ukraine and announces, and they're giving them trucks and training now, but, you know, not yet outright armaments, supposedly, anyway. If the U.S. arms Ukraine and announces that the policy is an explicit effort to kill more Russian soldiers fighting in Ukraine, its impact on Russian public opinion is likely to be the opposite of what advocates say they intend. Indeed, it could transform the war there from a popular but essentially optional effort to help separatist forces and civilians in eastern Ukraine into a necessary conflict against a hostile American proxy, which is what it really already is, right?
At the same time, for most Russians, it will probably confirm their government's overheated rhetoric about U.S. ambitions in Ukraine. I'm not so sure how overheated their rhetoric is, really. It will probably confirm their government's overheated rhetoric about U.S. ambitions in Ukraine in the minds of the Russian people and alleged American plans to force Russia to its knees or overthrow its government. Taken together, these shifts might increase Russians' tolerance of battlefield deaths and injuries rather more rapidly than new U.S. arms will or can increase Russian casualties. Moreover, the idea that more Russian deaths in Ukraine will, quote, expose Moscow's role in the fighting is ludicrous. While Vladimir Putin and others may deny that Russian troops are in Ukraine in official meetings and statements, commentators on government-controlled television channels discuss Russia's assistance to the separatists extensively. If the Kremlin were truly trying to conceal its participation, surely the Russian government would start by limiting this. On the contrary, Moscow's denials are a diplomatic position in communicating with foreign audiences, a polite fiction, and are widely understood as such inside the country. From this perspective, forcing Russia to publicly acknowledge its support for the separatists may not be such a good idea, especially if Washington pursues this in tandem with an effort to increase Russian casualties. In that environment, Putin may find it not only politically easier, but even politically important to escalate Russia's intervention. In fact, Russia's government could use American arms supplies to justify cross-border airstrikes and or much larger ground deployments. Kiev is in a poor position to defend itself in anything that approaches a real war with Russia. Continuing on. And so, point being, your intervention is stupid and obviously counterproductive. And Putin's not lying when he says that there are those in America who are trying to overthrow him, who would like very much to overthrow him. The head of the National Endowment for Democracy wrote that in the Washington Post during the start of the Maidan protests in the fall of 2013. He said if the Russians don't like it, maybe they're going to find themselves on the bad end of a color-coded revolution there in Moscow. And Gershman was his name. Carl Gershman wrote that in the Washington Post. And the National Endowment Democracy, that's the CIA's regime change operation, has been, you know, outsourced a bit there. They work together, of course, but that's all the NED is. Democracy, meaning coup d'etats in favor of American imperial interests, of course. Like always. All right, now, what time is it? Meh, I suck at this. Peter Van Buren. Well, send in the trainers. They've tried that, and that hasn't worked. Even Obama himself admitted at the G7 summit that, we got more training capacity than we've got recruits. Training capacity, we've only got a few hundred guys in there. So all the Shiite militias who are doing all the fighting, the people who would be the Iraqi army, they don't want to join the Iraqi army. They'll just stay with the Bada Brigade or etc. Insert name of Shiite militia here. There are quite a few to choose from. Mostly they're all the same as each other. 2, boots on the ground. John McCain says, you know, special forces and training and support for Iranian militias and these things, that's not going to do it. As General Zinni put it, we could put ground forces in there and we can destroy ISIS. Well, as the Washington Post and Gareth Porter are reporting, the military, first of all, just doesn't want to do it. And secondly, what could it possibly accomplish? As Van Buren puts it, we had 166,000 troops there. And all they did was fight the Sunni insurgency to a standstill and to a truce. What are they going to do now? They're going to drive the Islamic State out of Mosul, Fallujah, Ramadi at incredible human and financial cost, only to turn them back into an insurgency that they can't get rid of, that they couldn't before when they had 166,000 troops. So scratch that off your list. partnering with Iran. Counterproductive because it just makes the Islamic State seem right about what's going on here. The Americans, the Israelis, and the Iranians ganging up on them, you know, fulfills their narrative. Not that it's true. The Israelis and the Americans are mostly on their side, at least in the west of their country. But anyway, there is no coalition. As he says, remember all the propaganda about how our coalition Arab allies were going to invade and take care of this for us? No freaking way. Jordan, Saudi, Gulf states, never going to happen. Egypt, never going to happen. That they're going to do it for us. Arm the Kurds? Fine, but they're not going to invade and sack Mosul and get rid of the Islamic State for us either. They're going to hold their own territory only. And the political solution? It's too late for that by about 8 years. So, forget it. You blew it. Capiche? You blew it. Or, your plan succeeded perfectly, whichever you prefer there.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Live here weekdays from noon to 2 Eastern Time on the Liberty Radio Network. That's 11 to 1 Texas Time. Full interview archives and whole show archives at scotthorton.org. And our next guest today is Doug Bandow from the Cato Institute. And this one originally ran at the Washington Examiner. It's called, How Do You Fix a Problem Like Korea? Welcome back to the show, Doug. How are you doing?
Doing okay.
And I guess North Korea, South Korea, one big problem. What's the problem? Seems like everything over there is perfectly peaceful and fine. What's the matter?
Well, the problem, of course, is we don't know how long it'll remain perfectly peaceful. We have, you know, the North Koreans who are kind of mad at everybody. We have the South Koreans who are depending on America. We have the U.S., which is over there defending the South and irritating the Chinese. I mean, it's one of those things where everybody hopes nothing bad happens, but you never know. And if something bad did happen, it'd be a real mess.
Yeah. Well... And just how much of a mess would it be, really?
Well, if you had a real war, this would not be Serbia, this would not be Iraq. The North has nuclear weapons. We don't know exactly how many or if they're deliverable, but they also have a lot of chemical and biological stuff, and they have a big conventional force. So if somebody rolled the dice and war actually happened there, Seoul, South Korea would probably disappear. Yeah, we talk about hundreds of thousands of casualties. The U.S. and South Korea would win. But it's the kind of thing that no sane person wants.
Yeah, well, and I guess legend has it anyway that the North Koreans have more artillery tubes set up in hardened concrete bunkers right there on the DMZ than anybody could ever imagine. And they're right there within range of the capital city that even without nukes, they could basically reduce the capital of Seoul to rubble. Just with the amount of artillery that they have, and before the Americans or South Koreans could destroy them all. Is that really right?
Yeah, one of the estimates is something like 300,000 to 500,000 artillery shells per hour, they could put into Seoul. And I mean, assuming that that's anywhere close to the right estimate, obviously that, there wouldn't be a lot of Seoul left after that. So it's the kind of thing nobody who's sane wants.
Yeah, well, got that right. All right, so now... but listen, it's a unipolar world now, and America is the reluctant hero sheriff here keeping the peace, and the North Koreans are communists, Doug, communists, and they're the worst kind of people in the world. As you say, they got nukes, they're completely dangerous, and America has got to use its might to hold this status quo because it's better than any other alternative. What do you say about that?
What I find amazing about these kind of arguments, of course, is that no one ever pays attention to anybody else in the world. It's as if, there's America, the godless commies, and then kind of nothing. So, if America doesn't do it, what's going to happen? But, of course, South Korea has about 40 times the GDP. That is 40 times the GDP of North Korea. You have Japan has an interest in these issues. Japan has the, at this stage, the third largest kind of economic strength in the world. It's got a pretty competent military as well. You know, the question is, why don't America's allies step up to the plate? The point is, it's welfare. You know, if you're prepared to defend other countries, why on earth should they actually go out of their way to defend themselves? And that's the challenge we face, especially in Korea. South Koreans rely on us because we insist that they rely on us. So we have a defense treaty. Our job is to defend them. Their job is to be defended. You know, it's a pretty good deal if you're South Korean.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like for the empire, they much prefer that the communist dictatorship in North Korea lasts forever then.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of those where they don't actually sit there and say, now let's see, can we make that happen? But you're absolutely right. Frankly, it is in their interest because, you know, if all these bad guys disappeared, how on earth then would they be able to, demand to have a huge military and a globe-spanning, base structure and whatever? Mm-hmm. You know, they demand that because, isn't it awful, all the stuff out there? If that stuff disappeared, it'd be pretty hard to see how they'd convince anybody.
Yeah. Well, and it seems like they kind of do wear it on their sleeve. I don't know how often they really talk out loud about it, but there was a time when, in the Bush years, when the South Korean president and prime minister and whichever, I don't know their names, I used to know the man's name.
It'd be the president. He matters over there. The prime ministers are pretty kind of irrelevant.
Yeah, it was the president. I can't remember his name, though.
Probably Kim Dae-jung, early on.
Anyway, but it was the thing with where they were doing so much in the South to try to open up relations with the North, and how the Bush administration basically moved to stop them from doing it and said, we don't want to have any further negotiations about peace and reunification until we take care of the nuclear issue first. And then, of course, they just proceeded to make the nuclear issue completely intractable and serve to really make sure that peace and reunification is off the table.
That was a very bad time. The Bush administration coincided with two fairly liberal administrations over there, Kim Dae-jung and then Noh Moo-hyun. And, the U.S. was very much against their policy. So you had, kind of a very difficult situation where they were completely out of tune with each other. And the problem here is my reaction is I frankly don't care, what the South Koreans do in terms of policy. The problem is if we're defending them, then all of a sudden we have a right to go in there and tell them what we want because, we're prepared to defend them. And it's the reason I tell the South Koreans they shouldn't like this relationship because, it gets them kind of defense subsidies, but they really do lose control over their own policy, and that's hardly good for them.
Yeah. All right. Now, and I guess so the deal is, though, is the Americans really are worried about reunify. I guess the assumption is that if the North Korean government fell, that the peninsula would be reunified and probably obviously under South Korean leadership because of, as you said, they have the vast majority of power on balance there. And, of course, that would be a real hard reunification, the reconstruction of the North and this and that kind of thing. But on the other hand, I guess in the long term, that means a new Pacific power that the Americans have to deal with and without the threat that they've been protecting the South from. Makes them that much harder to control, right?
Well, I think that the presumption in Washington is if there was reunification, the South Koreans would still be our buddies. And the real hope in Washington is that South Korea will be our ally against China and will be part of this kind of attempt at containing China. And I actually don't think the South Koreans view that as being what they want to do. They don't want to make a permanent enemy out of China. What the South Koreans want is America to defend them from anybody who might attack them, but they don't want to have to do much beyond that. And that's where there's a real tension, where the U.S. Kind of assumes that South Korea will do America's bidding, and the South Koreans just want the U.S. to do as much as kind of South Korea wants. So I think over the long term, it's hard to see how that relationship works. And I think that there'd be real tensions with reunification for the reasons that you suggest, that is that South Korea would feel much more independent. And then it would decide why on earth should it go out there and kind of do what Washington wants. And the moment it stopped doing what Washington wanted, Washington would get rather upset.
Mm-hmm. And now you've been there to North Korea, huh?
Yeah, it's been a while. I mean, it's 20 years ago, so the place has changed. Very, very strange when I was there. Still strange, I think.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, I believe as you write in here, the famine is over now, but still life there is just like in the worst propaganda you can make up about the place, huh?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's, look, this is a place that the economy, the only reason it works today is that, in fact, there's a big black market, that the government has actually given up a lot of the controls out of necessity. You know, and that's for the good, and then that allows some people to go out there and produce stuff. You're seeing some private businesses and stuff emerge. But it's still a very hard life. This is a totalitarian state, and the government basically grabs, you know, everything that it wants for itself. It's not a place where any of us would want to live.
And now, I forget, I know that Bush Sr. pulled the nukes out of there when the Soviet Union fell apart, but now I'm trying to remember whether Bush had put them back.
No, I mean, at the moment, we have no no nukes over there.
Oh, okay.
There's been
that's
talk good. About whether we should put them back, but okay. They have not gone back.
All right. Well, that's good news, at least. All right. Well, we got Doug Bannon on the line. On the other side of this break, we're going to talk all about China and how America and China must and can get along. Right after this.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott. I'm talking with Doug Bandow. Writing at the National Interest for this one. Cato Institute guy, I should have said. So we were talking about North Korea, etc. But now, so let's switch to China. He's got a great one here at the National Interest. It's called How China and the United States Can Learn to Get Along. It's a review of Lyle J. Goldstein's new book, Meeting China Halfway. How to Defuse the Emerging U.S.-China Rivalry. And so I guess basically to set up here, you make a little bit of a comparison to the German challenge to British hegemony back 100 years ago and America and China's situation now. So if you could kind of explain that and then get to the part about how both sides have H-bombs. And so no world wars allowed. We got to figure out something else, Doug.
Well, you know, what's I think important is that, you know, we seem to act at times like everything's unique. And I think what if you look here, the big issue is how does the dominant power, that is America, deal with the rising power, which is China? You go back to the 1800s and, you know, Britain was the dominant power, not frankly as dominant as we are. But nevertheless, it was the rural Britannia. I mean, it kind of, you know, ran the sea waves. It was a big empire. The sun never set, et cetera, et cetera. And I think what's important here is that they dealt with challenges, and they had two big challengers. They had the United States, and they had Germany, both of which were industrializing, both of which were militarizing. You know, and the question is, how do you deal with that? And the British basically opted to conciliate and accommodate America. I mean, the U.S. made kind of outrageous claims in terms of, territory with its border with Canada and Mexico, et cetera. And the Brits pretty much gave in. You know, what they decided was, and I think correctly from their standpoint, was it made no sense to try to go toe-to-toe with America. You know, its interest in North America simply weren't as strong. You know, it couldn't afford to, it couldn't match it. And what you found was an enduring relationship. You know, it took some time. There were a lot of tensions, the Civil War and elsewhere. Nevertheless, they made the decision, you know, you're not going to kind of confront and fight and go to war with this rising power. You've got to find a way to get along. You know, they were much less forthcoming with Germany, and there were reasons for that. But nevertheless, the result with Germany was two world wars to try to figure out how everybody kind of sorted themselves out. If you step back and look at that, there's no doubt accommodation was a far better outcome than war. You know, and it strikes me that we should look at that. And, you know, no historical analogy is perfect, but you look at that and you say, what do you want to do? And my response would be, well, let's not go to war. I mean, we saw that in the past. Didn't work very well. We've got to find a way to work things out with China.
All right. So now really break it down for me here, because I know you come from a very libertarian point of view in terms of your economic understanding and all that, too, not just, you know, non-interventionist principle. But what exactly does America have to lose from the growth of China? And I mean America, the population between Bangor, Maine and San Diego, California, and, you know, the other way, too. Not necessarily the state. And I guess that's the second question then. What does the U.S. state have to lose from the rise of China, really?
Well, economically, you know, there are some people in America who will lose in the sense that, you know, trade means some people gain, some people lose. But overall, we win. I mean, overall, free trade is a good thing. You get cheap products. And I think over the long term, you know, we're having markets open up. This is a country that has a growing middle class. You're seeing Chinese investment in the United States. So overall, we win, but that doesn't mean that nobody loses. And I think that's always the challenge. Those people have political clout. You know, in the 2012 election, you had Romney and Obama both running ads in Ohio attacking each other for being wimpy on China. It was all over trade. It's a political issue in a certain way, I think, more than an economic issue, but it's a major one. You know, the American state worries about its dominance. That is, the U.S. Government, believes that its role in Asia is to continue to dominate. I mean, the U.S. wants to continue to kind of run everything along China's border. You know, and I just tell people, you don't have to like the Chinese government, and it's not a good government, but you don't have to like it to understand why Chinese are not thrilled, at the thought that the U.S. is kind of, running ships along its border, et cetera. You flip that around and say, what if the Chinese were sending its navy along the eastern seaboard and dictating policy towards Cuba? You know, if there were constant discussions in Beijing about, the necessity of war with America, Americans would respond. So I think we have to try to step back and look at things from their perspective. It doesn't mean, there's necessarily moral equivalence, but it does tell you got to understand what the other side's thinking. And to me, again, what you want to do is come up with a way of how do we work with them and realize, look, they're growing. They're not going to accept American domination on their border. You know, is that worth war for us? Well, somebody in the American state might think yes, but I think that's a crazy position.
Mm. All right. So I interviewed Alfred McCoy, and he was talking about how America's policies, and we could list them, I think you'll know what he has in mind, have really served to push China and Russia back together to heal that Sino-Soviet split of old. And he seemed really worried that this means the end of dollar hegemony. This means the end of American, rule from the rim, and the world island will fall into the hands of the Russian-Chinese alliance. And that this is really going to hurt the Americans, ultimately. The more they get along, the less power the American state has around the old world, the less well-off the American people will be. I mean, and I don't think he was really an advocate of empire, but he was saying, we have to face up to the unface-up-toable here. We're going to lose everything when we lose our empire, which is happening now.
Well, I think that it's fair to be concerned if two authoritarian governments kind of get together because they don't like you. And that, I mean, that's the oddity of the hawkish policy, is all these people who want America to be dominant have come up with kind of the one way, of all things, the one way to convince China and Russia to work together. I mean, you have to kind of, in certain ways, compliment, the neocons for their ability here. I mean, the only problem is it's not what they intended. They're horrified by it, but it is their policy. There are a lot of things that should keep China and Russia apart. Look, if you're a Russian, you worry about Siberia. I mean, there are 3 or 4 million Russians there, and that's it. It's empty. An awful lot of Chinese nearby. So you look at kind of the rising power of China eventually can easily threaten Russia. But at the moment, from their standpoint, the U.S. is a bigger thing that pulls them together than the issues that divide them. That's all Washington's fault. So the easy answer to that is stop doing it. I mean, to me, this is one of the most curious things. If one's worried about pushing those two countries together, Washington has an easy answer, which is to stop doing what it's doing. I mean, that's what's doing it. Well, stop it. Then you'll be okay.
Well, how true is it that overall the American Republic suffers from losing its empire?
Well, I don't think it suffers from losing its empire. I mean, I do think, in a world in which I think that both, the governments in both Russia and China strike me as not being the most friendly to human rights and liberty. Yeah, so I probably don't want those states being particularly strong either. That, you know, I worry about them working together. You know, so if it was only America, you know, not having its empire, then I'm pretty happy, because actually I think we're better off without an empire. We're better off if we're not threatening to go to war to maintain influence. What I worry about is that we might find ourselves with some negatives in there that we hadn't intended, and, you know, they'd be kind of inadvertent. It's not something which anyone is thinking about, but it's a natural result of the policy.
Mm. Well, and I mean, that's basically what they always say, right? If it's not us, it'd be them. So we have to.
Well, you know, I'm not worried about the sense of, oh my goodness, the Chinese will fill the void. I mean, you know, the reality is, you know, the book that I review by Lyle Goldstein. Lyle is actually on staff at the Naval War College. I mean, he's a serious guy. He's a professor. He teaches military folks. He had me up at a conference 2 or 3 years ago to talk about these issues. I was probably the only one there who wasn't beating the war drum. So Lyle is a really, really solid guy who's very much for peace. You know, that, you know, my view is that the reality is China's going to be more important in its region. And what we want is basic countries around it should be willing to adapt. And in fact, they are. I mean, everybody there is building submarines. And thankfully, they're not building submarines because of America. My reaction is that's great. That's the natural reaction to China. It's not our doing. We don't have to tell anybody to do this. You know, they naturally do it because they don't want China running their lives. Well, that's frankly the way it should work. So to me, that's the real answer, is that I'm just nervous, you know, where you have, I mean, Vladimir Putin and you know, President Xi, neither of these are particularly friendly guys. I'd prefer that they not be particularly powerful either, but I don't think the U.S. should be intervening militarily to try to stop them from doing things in their neighborhood.
Yep. All right, well, I'm sorry we're out of time, but everybody please go and check out Doug Bandow at Cato and at nationalinterest.org, how China and the U.S. can learn to get along. And where the hell did this other one go, man? How do you fix a problem like Korea? Thanks, Doug.
Hey, happy to be on. Take care now.
Appreciate it. See y'all tomorrow.